heavy fighting is still raging.
3,639 wounded.
Red light, green light, and out, out. Get
gentlemen,
out.
This is the real thing.
The brutal death march of Bataan.
Germany calling. Germany calling.
Right in the Fuhrer's face.
You're listening to Veterans Chronicles, presented by the American Veterans Center and the Radio America Network. In this episode of Veterans Chronicles, host Dr. Lewis Sorley talks with World War II veteran Robert Calvert Jr. as we learn about his experience leaving college to join the Army and the difficulties of fighting in the Battle of the Bulge.
Welcome to Veterans Chronicles. Our guest this week is Robert Calvert Jr., a veteran of World War II service, a publisher, an educator, and the author of a wonderful memoir entitled An American Life, which he has provided for his friends and family. Welcome, Bob.
I'm glad to be here.
We need to start out with getting you launched somehow before we march forward to your military service, so could you please start by telling us a little about where you're from, what your family background was, and your early education?
Yeah, I was born in California. I grew up in a town called Scarsdale, New York. I finished high school there in 1941. My father was a Ph.D. chemist and a patent lawyer, and I was one of three children, oldest.
You were the oldest. Yeah, 41 was a sort of impressive time to be launched.
Well, it began very peacefully. Yeah,
yes.
But ended up very warlike.
And were you in school then?
Yeah, I went from high school to Oberlin College in Ohio.
To college.
And one Sunday we came back from our Sunday dinner and put on the radio, and there the Japanese had bombed Pearl Harbor. At the time I was 18 years old, and the minimum draft age was 20, so I was fairly assured of spending another year or so in college. Although I was always very anxious to get into the war, but not as early as some did.
I remember that day very well. Also, my sister and I were on the living room floor where my father was reading us the funny papers. And on the radio, we heard the same thing that you just described.
Was this at a military base?
This was just outside Fort Sam Houston, where my father was stationed in San Antonio. But everyone of a certain age remembers exactly when and where they heard news.
It's like the Kennedy assassination or Martin Luther King. You remember what just where you were at the time.
That's right. It's indelible, isn't it? So you're out in Oberlin. You get to finish, a second year?
I'll tell you what happened, Bob. In November of 42, the college called off all classes, and they had a number of recruiters come in from the various services, and each of them gave a spiel for their service, Navy, Marines, Army, Air Corps, I guess that's all, are in the Army, too. And it was announced to the students that you're going to go into service. You might as well pick your service. And of the services, the Navy offered by far the most enticing option. You would go into, if you joined their V-12 or V-5, you'd stay in school, get at least another year of college in, go directly to midshipman or their OCS, and get a commission. If you signed up for the Army, you'd go in as a private and make it from there. And that's what most of us did.
Yes. Well, when did you enter service and where did you go initially?
Yeah, I entered service in May of 1943. I got a letter from the I signed up for the Enlisted Reserve Corps. I got a letter from the Army reporting me to report for Camp Upton, New York, on May 29, 1943, and it came the week before finals. And the college had a wonderful rule that if you were drafted or qualified for service in the last couple of weeks of a term, you didn't have to take the finals. So that was a huge plus.
What a benefit.
So I hitchhiked home, had a week at home before I went in service. I picked up a study book for the Army gave you a sort of an IQ test when you entered.
Mm-hmm.
And I spent a week studying for that test, assuming it might help me. And it really did. It affected my career, not in a way I always wanted it to, but it did affect what I did. So I reported to Camp Upton and stayed there about 2 weeks, and then was put on a giant trainload of people for Macon, Georgia. Going to go to Camp Wheeler, Georgia, which is an infantry replacement training center, for take their 13-week basic training cycle.
Any friends with you at this point, or are you on your own?
I had a wonderful group of people with whom I took basic training, none of whom I knew before, but they were mostly all, like me, college students.
Uh-huh.
People from Union College, Colgate, this is all from the New York State area.
Yes.
And wonderful guys. We had an incredible platoon.
So when you got finished with that, you went through the 13 weeks, you know, it's a lot longer than they give them these days.
Well, I'll tell you what happened. Yeah. They, after week nine, we were told it was going to be 17 weeks.
Hmm.
So they added on to our 13 weeks, so we were there from June until October.
Uh-huh.
And then the Army had set up a thing called the Army Specialized Training Program. I think it was kind of a dumb program, but it was kind of an anti. The Navy had this fancy program. The Army wanted a program, too. Now, some parts of it were very good. They had a Japanese language training thing at Michigan, other things. But people like Bob Dole and Henry Kissinger and Gore Vidal and even me were picked for that program. They just simply took the 12 people from my infantry training company with the highest IQ test scores. So that's one case where that score affected what I did.
And where did they send you?
The University of Kentucky at Lexington.
Uh-huh. And did you pick a program of instruction, or did they have one that
they
gave you?
They picked it for me, and it was hell. It was so boring. I already had everything in the program but the mathematics. We had to be in our rooms six nights a week studying. The girls would come around and serenade us, but we couldn't get out to see them.
Oh, dear.
So then what happened around March of 1944, General Marshall was worried about the shortage of people.
Especially infantrymen, I think.
Yeah, and he wanted to begin to draft fathers who previously had been exempt.
Yes.
And they decided they would rather cut out the ASDP program and put 140,000 people back in the ranks than they would draft fathers, which they did anyway a couple months later, but it was a short-term thing.
You know, it's interesting to me what you said so far, that they apparently were taking a fairly long-term perspective on the duration of the war, you know, with these programs like ASDP. And with the length of basic training that you went through and so on, they were looking at it even in those early years as not likely to be wrapped up anytime soon, were they?
I think that's a very good point. I was put into the first year of this engineering program. Would I spend three more years in college? And when I get out with a bachelor's in engineering, would that make that much difference in the war?
Yeah.
You're right. But, you know, wars are full of waste. You know, we spent billions on chemical warfare in World War II and never used it.
Yeah. This was a very difficult thing for Mr. McNamara to accept at a later period, that there's waste involved in war.
That's right.
Well, when they disestablished this ASTP program, what happened to you?
They sent us all to Camp Fort Leonard Wood, Missouri, where we took a half-baked engineering basic training program and called us engineers, and they began to send us overseas.
So were you an engineer at that point, huh? Your MOS.
I was classed as an engineer, yes.
Right.
Actually, I had an engineering and infantry MOS, both of classes, both infantry and engineering.
Right.
But infantry was really where I knew the most.
And now you're destined for what, overseas?
We went overseas to via Camp Reynolds in Pennsylvania. One day, seven trains came to pick us up there. I mean, not railroad cars, seven trains.
Yes.
Something like 14,000 people left to go overseas from that camp. We were shipped out of Camp Shanks in New York, and I left New York in late June of 1944 in a huge convoy destined for Liverpool.
So you knew where you were going at least that far, anyhow.
I was going what?
You knew how far where you were destined, at least as far as Liverpool.
No.
No, you didn't know that, huh?
In the Army, you never know anything. You know, if you jumping ahead, but you know, if we were going to have an operation that day, we'd be told we're going to go to the woods over there. We would never know whether the woods were to be part of taking a town or just to, you know, clear the woods or what. You know, you were told very little.
Yeah.
In combat, and told very little for security purpose when you went overseas. You know, the deal was you don't tell anybody anything.
So what was the situation on this ship? Was it typically sardine crowded and all like that, or what was the deal?
It was very crowded. There were three bunks were three high. We were down in a hold. We had a bathroom there that was full of leaky faucets, and there was normally water slushing on the floor. We were fed twice a day at 10 a.m. and 4 p.m. You ate standing up in a steamy mess hall.
We'll take a break here, and then we'll return to our conversation with Robert Calvert, Jr., a veteran of World War II service in Europe.
Coming up, Mr. Calvert describes his journey to England and eventually to Normandy.
Veterans Chronicles is now available wherever you are.
Through your MP3 player.
Log on to www.radioamerica.org.
And click on the podcasting icon.
Look for Veterans Chronicles. Then follow the information on your screen to subscribe to our podcast.
You can also find the Veterans Chronicles podcast on Apple iTunes.
The Veterans Chronicles podcast.
Now online
at radioamerica.org.
You're listening to Veterans Chronicles, presented by the American Veterans Center and the Radio America Network. Now back to Veterans Chronicles host Dr. Lewis Sorley and World War II veteran Robert Calvert Jr.
Welcome back to Veterans Chronicles. This is Lewis Sorley. We're continuing our conversation with Robert Calvert Jr., a veteran of service in Europe during World War II. When we left off, Bob, we were talking about your arriving in England and going into a replacement depot where, surprisingly, you and others languished for considerable time. What happens finally when you are released from that?
Well, I finally arrived at a packet of men in late September. We crossed from Southampton to beaches of Normandy. I remember walking up the beach Sunday night. On the right was a huge cemetery full of white crosses. Not a very encouraging first view of France.
No, I wouldn't think so. And about what time period is this now?
It's been September of 1944. And then we went from there to Etampes, France, another replacement depot, and finally from there to a little depot in town of Sion, which is in the Vosges area of France. About 10 miles from Domremy, where Joan of Arc came from.
Your memory is quite remarkable. I'm impressed that you know remember all those way stations before you finally got to an outfit. And what was that, and where?
Well, I've read my book. But any event, I was there for maybe a month, and nobody ever called us up. It's strange because the Army was hurting for replacements.
Yes,
and then. Day after Thanksgiving, we finally got our orders to go, and I joined was assigned to the 4th Armored Division.
one of the great outfits of World War II. I'm sure you know that it's one of only three divisions that received the Presidential Unit Citation for its service.
That's right. Yeah.
What kind of an assignment did they give you?
I was assigned to the 51st Armored Infantry Battalion, C Company, 1st Platoon. I joined the company. I didn't know whether I'd find men fighting Germans by hand or what, but it was a very peaceful setting in the maybe Alsace area of France, and I was assigned to the 1st Platoon, and the platoon leader, Lieutenant Kaiser, wandered out of a building and looked at us and said, not welcome to the division, but he said, how many of them are there? And he said, anybody want to be in the mortar squad? I put my hand up. I thought that was a good place to start. I became a mortarman with this company.
This engineering background went by the boards pretty quickly then.
Yeah. No, I was glad to be there. I mean, I felt this was a war that was important, and I should be willing to take my chance in it.
What was the situation in that unit as you viewed it with your limited experience when you got there?
Well, the division had landed in Normandy in July, had led a spearhead across France, and had a reputation that was excellent. By the time I got there, most of the men who had landed in Normandy were gone. Most of our squad leaders had landed as privates in Normandy, and now they were sergeants. It was mostly was more replacements than they were regular members of the unit. My first days of combat were mostly marked by the nights, which were very long, and you didn't sleep much at night. So my problem with combat was you were always so tired you wondered if it was worth living.
Yes. You're carrying a rifle, basically.
Right.
And you've joined now late November, I guess, and you right away you're in combat.
Yes.
And now we're going to get up to your first really a crucial thing that you're involved in. The Battle of the Bulge breaks out in mid-December, 16th of December, I guess. Where were you then, and how did you learn that about this crisis?
Well, I spent a couple of weeks in the Saar area of France in combat. We lost a lot of people. Our company was down to 50 people. We pulled back.
What normally would it have been if it were full
strength? 150, 200.
Yeah.
But we pulled back one day, and there were 100 men waiting to join us, so we were beefed up. We went to an arrest area in near Nancy in France. And one day we heard about a huge German attack in Belgium. And we were alerted that night, left the next morning, half-tracks, tank, went up icy roads. Patton had been given the assignment to cut through from roughly Arlon to reach Bastogne. And it was only maybe 20 miles, of which the first 5 miles were nothing, but the last 15 miles were very tough.
And it's the dead of winter.
And so we took off, and about the third night, the big problem in all this was the weather.
Yes.
I mean, you were fighting the weather as much as you were the Germans.
And were you walking?
Yes, we'd walk, yeah. Yes. Yeah.
Let's leave it there for a moment. We'll take a break, and after that, we'll continue our conversation with Robert Calvert, Jr., a veteran of World War II in Europe.
Coming up, Mr. Calvert describes the extreme conditions at the Battle of the Bulge. Veterans Chronicles is presented by the American Veterans Center, an educational foundation dedicated toward preserving the legacy of America's servicemen and servicewomen of all generations. The center is home to two organizations, the World War II Veterans Committee and the National Vietnam Veterans Committee, each working to tell the stories of their respective veterans. In addition to this program,
The American Veterans Center is also the primary sponsor of the National Memorial Day Parade, held annually in Washington, D.C. For more information on the American Veterans Center and its programs, visit the center's website at www.americanveteranscenter.org or call 703-302-1012, 703-302-1012.
You're listening to Veterans Chronicles, presented by the American Veterans Center and the Radio America Network. And now back to World War II veteran Robert Calvert Jr. and host Dr. Louis Sorley.
Welcome back to Veterans Chronicles. We're continuing our conversation with Robert Calvert Jr., a veteran of World War II in the European theater. And as we stepped away, Bob, we were talking about the approach to the Battle of the Bulge. Let's pick it up there, please.
Yeah, we, it's about a 10 or 12 day campaign. About the first night out, my lieutenant, Lieutenant Kaiser, was killed as he slept, not in a foxhole, but on top of the ground. And a mortar landed near him and killed him. That was the first of many changes of command. The second day, we had orders to about 5 o'clock in the evening to drive to Bastogne. Don't stop, just go. Now, this may have looked very easy to a planner back in Third Army headquarters who was looking at a map, but the ground was covered with snow. The tankers couldn't see whether there was a ravine or a rock or something, so they just couldn't do it. So about 10 p.m., they stopped. They made a circle like covered wagons would do in the old days, and we were there, stuck there for the night. It was very cold. You had to keep moving to avoid freezing to death. And next morning, I think we lost like 17 people because of frostbite or cold or pneumonia, including our company commander and my platoon sergeant.
What were you furnished in the way of winter clothing and so on?
Well, I had been very cold in the SAR campaign, so I wore two pairs of woolen underwear, two pairs of trousers, two pairs of shirts, and covered it all up with a so-called tanker sort of overall outfit. So I was pretty warm, except if I had to walk very far, I wouldn't be able to make, because I would have been dehydrated.
Yes.
But in any event, we kept taking, moving through the woods. We attacked Germans on the side of a hill, and one of our men was run over by a tank as it went backwards. My platoon sergeant had gone, so my squad leader became platoon sergeant, and he was hit. We had about three different platoon sergeants in the course of 5 or 6 days.
What was this? Excuse me.
At one time, our company had zero officers in it.
Really?
Yeah.
So who was leading?
We had two. The first two were hit in an ambush. The next one, my platoon leader, was hit sleeping at night. Next one was the captain left with a pneumonia after this all-night thing in the middle of the woods there, and one officer was hit as he was trying to break up captured German weapons. So we were down to zero officers.
Were these casualties the ones that resulted from enemy activity, not being banked over by a tank and so on? Were those largely caused by indirect fire, or were you able to see and exchange direct fire with the enemy?
We saw very few Germans. Yeah, maybe three or four times we actually saw Germans, but it was mostly a matter of their firing. They seemed to know where we were better than we knew where they were. And they'd fire mortar shots in at night. And one day we got five replacements, and their first night in combat, we were changing guard. And the mortar shots came in and killed two of them.
How rapidly were you progressing toward Bastogne? Was it in?
I'd say maybe a mile or two every day.
Yeah,
you normally went from one woods to another woods.
Yes.
But one day I know I dug three different foxholes because I wasn't sure where we were going to stop for the night.
So wherever you stopped, you got one.
Yeah.
You made one. And this is in frozen ground. That had to be hard.
It was frozen ground, and they're in the edge of a pine woods. There were pine roots.
Yes.
So it kept us entertained.
But having seen what you've already described, you were motivated to get down.
Yeah. One day we came to a little house in the woods. And my squad leader, who was my best friend, acting squad leader, said, I'm going to go up and check the house out. I told him I wouldn't go by myself, but if you give me Morgan, I'd go up with Morgan. So Morgan, I told Morgan, who's a new guy, to go up on the right. I'd go up on the left. We went up to this house, little house in the woods. Nothing happened. We went to the back of the house. Nothing happened. Went to the front of the house. We're standing there about to wave our platoon up when all of a sudden the door broke open and about 10 tough-looking German paratroopers came out. They figured that their war was over.
So they weren't looking for a fight. They were looking
up. They could easily have killed us.
Sure. But instead they allowed you to take them prisoner?
Right. They were cut off anyway. They were isolated. They could have fought it out and to the end, but they decided it was better to go back to America and spend the time in a camp in Oklahoma.
That was probably pretty good thinking on their parts.
Yeah, that's right.
How long did it take to get to Bastogne?
Roughly 10 to 12 days. One day, I was getting all the tough jobs at about this time. You could always tell kind of how you were regarded. And I was getting a lot of the tough jobs. And one day I was told to take another guy and go up and check this village out that we were coming to, Saint-Lez, Belgium. And so I took up Whitey with me, and he went left and I went right. And he came across a German machine gun nest, which he tried to take by himself and was killed. Oh. But that was a big day. And then I got the nice job of walking German prisoners back to the rear, which is one of the best jobs you could have in the infantry.
Yes, I would think so. Well, as all these casualties, friendly casualties that you've described are taking place, I think you're progressively moving up in responsibility and eventually in rank. Is that correct?
Well, I was acquiring seniority rapidly for the wrong reasons.
Well, you were surviving, though, so that's not a bad reason there.
Well, as a matter of fact, in my platoon, 38 people began this campaign, and only five of us went all the way. Most of them were not killed.
Yes.
But they were frozen feet, wounded.
Yeah. What about your own health as you're going along? Are you avoiding those kinds of problems?
Yeah, I was fine. I surprisingly, it was very cold, so cold the water in your canteens froze, so you couldn't drink it. You had to take snow and melt it or just simply swallow snow.
Really?
To get liquid.
Are you being fed? What's the situation
there?
Oh, yeah.
We had K-rations brought up and so on.
Yes.
At night we would dig in, and the Army would send up one blanket per person. Now, one brown blanket isn't very much when it's like 18 degrees outside.
No.
But
that's what you had, huh?
That was the deal.
No sleeping bags, I guess, huh?
Oh, no. Lord, no. No, yeah. That they would be very vulnerable to being caught. The Germans, I think, had been at war a long time, so they loved to spend the nights in towns. We were newcomers, and we'd spend the nights out in the fields.
What do you remember about reaching Bastogne? Did your unit actually enter Bastogne?
Yeah, we came out of the woods one day, and there's a big field ahead of us, and up on the far horizon was the best-looking defensive position we'd seen yet. all kinds of foxholes and machine guns, and we began to move toward it, and not far, but almost ready to open fire when our company commander came out and said, "Don't shoot. That's 101st Airborne." So we finally had reached them. I went up to make personal contact with them, and
yes,
said hello and all that kind of stuff.
You talked to some soldiers from 101st.
Yeah, but they looked much better than we did. You know, we were really all beat up, and they looked like they were more rested. Although they were a very heroic outfit and very good outfit.
Other veterans of the 4th Armored have told me the same thing, that comparatively speaking, they looked rested and fit,
yeah,
and better clothed,
yeah,
and so on. Of course, they had been holed up there, and
that's right.
You guys had been slogging your way through to that. Many people seem to think that after Bastogne was reached and entered by the 37th Tank Battalion 1st and the Ur outfit also, and I suppose other elements of the 4th Armored, that was the end of the Battle of the Bulge, but it wasn't true, was it?
Well, no, there were Germans all around the place, and we actually spent about next 2 weeks dug in to keep the corridor we had established open. And we were not engaged in combat at the time, although we did lose men every day from things like artillery fire or mortar fire or just being worn down by the weather. But we were given replacements, and we were getting ready to go back and become reorganized.
Were you aware of our own counter efforts, such as outgoing artillery fire, close air support, that type of thing?
No.
If that was happening, it was farther back than you.
Yeah, there were units that were attacking, but we were sort of depleted. We were kind of at the end of our rope. We were down to very few old timers. We're getting replacements pretty generously, but we were not really able to take the offensive for a while.
Are you by this time a squad leader?
Yeah, I was made a squad leader after the Bulge, and I was given became a rifle squad to lead. And interesting, at that time the Army was really scraping the barrel. I had 10 men. I think three of them had been cooks.
Huh.
Three of them were retreads from the field artillery, coastal artillery, I'm sorry. Two of them were fathers who didn't want to be there. And two of them were just young kids out of basic training, 18, 19 years old. So
yeah,
it was a mixed bag.
I'll bet it was.
Actually, before the war was over, every single one of those people was either wounded or killed.
You had something of a charmed life, but
yeah, I was lucky. Well, I had two killed, and one wounded so badly that he never worked in his life.
Really? This is all taking place in Belgium around Bastogne.
Yeah,
and eventually you're going to march on and enter Germany.
Yes, we went back to Luxembourg. We stayed with a wonderful family in a town called Pompierre. We were there a couple of occasions. The people in the town became attached to the soldiers who were housed in their homes. Last time we left, they came to the square. They were all crying we were leaving because we had been kind of an interesting interlude in what was then a rather boring, long war. But we went, we crossed into Germany in late February, and that time the German army was beginning to crumble.
Could you sense that?
Yeah, although they were still dangerous. One day they hit my squad, and they killed one and wounded one very badly, so they were still dangerous. But I remember going into one town and up on the hill watching about 800 German troops surrender, walk by.
Hmm.
It was very good news.
Coming up in our Profiles in Valor segment, host Tim Hulbert of the American Veterans Center speaks with Major Robert Nesbitt, Jr., U.S. Army, a Bronze Star recipient for his service during Operation Iraqi Freedom.
This is Tim Hulbert from the American Veterans Center, inviting you to join us for our upcoming 12th annual conference, November 12th through the 14th in Washington, D.C. The conference is your opportunity to meet some of America's greatest military heroes from World War II through Iraq and Afghanistan, hearing their stories of valor firsthand. Confirmed participants include General David Petraeus, commander of CENTCOM, Air Force Colonel and retired astronaut Buzz Aldrin, several of the Band of Brothers from World War II, Baseball Hall of Famer and World War II vet Bob Feller, Dutch Van Kirk, navigator of the Enola Gay, recipients of the Medal of Honor, veterans portrayed in the film Black Hawk Down, decorated heroes from today's military, and much, much more. Conference attendees are also invited to exclusive receptions, including one honoring our wounded warriors currently recovering at Walter Reed Army Medical Center. To request a full schedule or registration form, visit our website at www.AmericanVeteranCenter.org. Call 703-302-1012, extension 220, or email avc@AmericanVeteranCenter.org. That's avc@AmericanVeteranCenter.org. Spend Veterans Day weekend in the company of heroes.